We're in a series where I should make an apology too. Some of you out there know what a predicate nominative is, and you have looked at this title, and it has bothered you ever since. Because most English speakers say, "Is this him?" But it should be, "Is this he?" I recognize that, and I had to swallow my grammarian pride and change it for what is recognizable to most of you. So if you would forgive me, and it's no longer going to distract you now, we can move on from that. But this is the series, and that is the title we chose, right or wrong. And we're just looking throughout the history of the Old Testament and looking at the people that point to Christ. The spoiler is there. We already know how this ends, and we already know the answer as we look at each of these people. But it's good to, and my goal really is to grow that anticipation in us, for us to really appreciate who Jesus was by looking at who these people weren't. And I hope too, as you leave, that you've been encouraged, you've been challenged, and you have been changed in your relationship with God, that you would be different leaving through those two doors than when you came in this week. And so we're going to begin in Exodus chapter 3 for this morning, and it's kind of more of a survey, so we're gonna move through Exodus relatively quickly and pick up a few different chapters here and there. But if you grab one of the Bibles in the back, we're going to begin on page 49. If you grab one of those Bibles that we offer for you. And if you grab one of those Bibles and you don't have a Bible, you didn't have one to bring because you don't have one at home, that's our gift to you. You take that, it's yours, take it home, and we just ask that you use it. Use it, study it, and if you don't know where to start, go to the book of John and start there. It's a great place to begin. But we're going to be looking in Exodus, and I just want to remind you where we started. We're not going to start with a story this morning. I know last week we started with a story, and some of you had mentioned the Bible that I used for that story. That was the Jesus Storybook Bible, and I will tell you, it's not just for kids, because reading it profoundly gives you a different perspective, a different way of understanding just the connection of God's promise and who Jesus truly was. And so don't be ashamed as adults if you want to go purchase that Bible and read through it, because it brings me to tears, even though it's a kid's book. It's not a translation, it's a paraphrase, it's almost a commentary, but Jesus Storybook Bible, if you're interested in that book. So when Adam and Eve sinned, as a result, they were separated from God, and they were condemned to die apart from Him, and they were condemned to experience life in a limited way, in ways that they weren't meant to. Humanity, because of Adam and Eve, was broken. And there, as their story reveals, as you follow Adam and Eve and their family, that sin is a problem, not just for Adam and Eve. Sin is a problem for everyone. They pass it on. They pass it down to Cain, and they discover that sin is in him. Sin is inside everyone. Because of Adam and Eve, we all sin. And because we all sin, we are all condemned to die. And we will die because of Adam and Eve, separated from God. But within that punishment, because of the sin, there's reason to hope. When we saw this last week in the Jesus Storybook Bible, God promises Satan that Eve's offspring will crush Satan and his offspring is sin. And so the Storybook Bible says it this way, that just before they left, God whispered a promise to Adam and Eve. "It will not always be so. I will come to rescue you, and when I do, I'm going to battle against the snake, and I'll get rid of the sin and the dark and the sadness you let in here. I'm coming back for you." And he would. One day, God himself would come. That was the promise. That was within the punishment. That was the hope that they had. And unfortunately, it wasn't the one that was supposed to come and defeat sin and Satan. It wasn't their son, Cain. It wasn't their son, Seth. As we studied last week, the text brings up the possibility, is it Noah? Is maybe Noah the one to end sin, but it's not Noah. Noah isn't the sin crusher, but he does reinforce to us and teach us that sin is a problem for everyone and cannot be solved by just anyone, right? That's what Noah teaches us, that he's the most righteous man on earth at his time, and he can't end sin. Your righteousness won't save you from your sin, let alone anyone else's sin. And because you're just not good enough. And if Noah wasn't good enough, we are not going to be good enough. Even the most righteous person in the world wasn't saved by his efforts to end sin, his morality. He was saved by his faith. And your faith is what will save you, we learned last week. Not in yourself. It has to be in the sin crusher. It has to be in the one to defeat Satan and sin. It wasn't Noah. And so this morning I want to take a look at another candidate for the role of sin crusher, the one that maybe is he the offspring that ends sin and defeats Satan, and see what this person can teach us as well. So about 600 years after the flood, the Bible tracks the movement of a family descended from a 10th generation of Noah's middle son, Shem. So 10 generations after Shem, there's a man born named Abraham, and the Bible narrows in and focuses on his family once Abraham hits the scene. And with Abraham, we begin to, again, track the offspring. That hope is still there, that in this family there is going to be a person born that will defeat sin, and it's in Abraham's family. And the reason this happens, the reason the Bible narrows its focus to Abraham, that we know that in Abraham's family this is going to happen, is because God chose Abraham to be the recipient of a covenant with him. This covenant, when it happens, draws our attention, the reader's attention, as we're working our way through the Bible, back to God's rescue plan, back to the plan to save people from sin and darkness. And so Genesis chapter 12 is where we are brought, our attention is brought back to the plan. Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 to 3, God says to Abram, his name is Abram at this moment, it'll change to Abraham later on, but he tells him, go from your country, your people and your father's household to the land that I will show you. And I will make you into a great nation and I will bless you. I will make your name great and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. This is a covenant. This is a promise that God makes with Abraham where he revisits humanity. After Noah, after the flood, he revisits Abraham, and he makes this covenant with him. It's an unbreakable promise that God makes Abraham in order to move forward with the plan to rescue humanity. And the promise to Abraham here is to make him into a great nation of descendants. And with land in Canaan, which is modern Israel, that's the land he ends up showing Abraham. And out of, or in Abraham, literally one of his offspring, through him, will bless the world. And that last one, out of you, all nations of the world will be blessed. The last one recalls the hope and the curse and speaks to the plan. And the meaning is universally agreed that God is promising Abraham here that one of his offspring will give hope. One of his descendants will be a blessing, will give redemption to the world. And then he has a son or two. But the blessing, the offspring, the sin crusher, is not his son Isaac and it's not his son Ishmael. It's not his grandson, Jacob. And then he has 12 great-grandsons. Jacob has 12 sons. And maybe it's one of them. And those great-grandsons moves to Egypt, away from the land of Canaan, thanks to a famine and also the leadership and the graciousness of one of their youngest brothers, Joseph. But none of those great-grandsons is the one, the blessing. And then for them, things get a lot worse. They have this promise, but things aren't looking good. And the very beginning of the book of Exodus, in Exodus chapter 1, Moses writes this about this family. Joseph and all his brothers and all of that generation died. So the great-grandsons of Abraham, the carriers of the promise, died. But the Israelites, their descendants, were exceedingly fruitful and they multiplied greatly. They increased in numbers and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. But this isn't the land of Canaan. This isn't in the promised land. This is the land of Egypt where they moved because of famine. And a new king to whom Joseph, the one that led them there, meant nothing, came to power in Egypt. And look, he said to his people, the Egyptians, the Israelites, these are the children there of the descendants of Abraham, have become far too numerous for us. We must deal shrewdly with them or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, they'll join our enemies and they'll fight against us from within and then leave the country. And so they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And they built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. And so the people, the family that's supposed to be going to introduce and produce the blessing to the world, the sin crusher, they're slaves. Right? They're hated. They're facing infanticide and population control. And within that dark time, Moses, a little boy, is born to Levi's house, one of the 12 sons, one of the 12 grandsons of Abraham. Moses is born to Levi's grandson named Amram. And Moses' birth gets a lot of attention, more so as you read the Old Testament. You don't get a lot of attention on some of these births, but Moses' birth gets a lot of attention in this time. It's unusual. It's clear to us that we're meant to notice, as we read the Old Testament, we're meant to notice Moses, that he is different somehow, that Moses is significant and meant to begin to ask the question, is Moses the blessing? Is Moses the one? And his story gets rocky. Right, I'm not going to go through much of what happens in his early life. He lives in exile from Egypt for years because he defended a Hebrew slave, but in defending him, he murdered an Egyptian slave master, overseer. And so he lives in exile, and in that exile, we pick up his story in Exodus chapter 3, verse 1. So Moses is tending the flock of Jethro. This is Exodus 3, verse 1. His father-in-law is a priest of Midian, and Moses led the flock of sheep to the far side of the wilderness, and he came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And there the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. And Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. And so Moses thought, I'm going to go over and see this strange sight, why the bush doesn't burn up. And when the Lord saw that Moses had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. And then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And at this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. So God, in this moment, steps directly into Moses' story to introduce himself, or reintroduce himself to humanity again. And something is going on here. The bush probably gives us away that something significant is going on here. This isn't just a normal, everyday interaction. But I want you to see God's words as he begins to explain to Moses himself and what's going on, because it's significant. Verse 7, so the Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. The cry of the Israelites has reached me. I've seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go, I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. So I want you to notice here as God begins to reintroduce himself to men, to Moses. But notice that God talks about his people, right? My people. And this is clearly in regards to the covenant that he made with Abraham. He starts with that way. I am the God of Abraham. We're going to talk about my people. We're going to talk about my covenant with them. And so he has that covenant in mind in his conversation. I promised them land. I promised them a nation. I promised them a blessing, the blessing, but they're slaves. And so God says, and I love this, he says, I have seen, I have heard, I am concerned, and I have come down to rescue. You see that in verse 8. I have seen, I have heard, I'm concerned, verse 8. So I have come to rescue them. They're not in the land. They're not a nation. They're not a blessing. But God has come to rescue them, and he has his covenant with Abraham in mind. And so we begin to wonder as we read the story, is this the plan? Is this the rescue plan? He used the word rescue. Is this the plan? And then he says in verse 10, this is the kicker, he says to Moses, so you go, I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people out. I'm sending you, Moses, you're going to rescue them. And when you do, He says, you're going to worship me. You're going to worship on this mountain. In verse 12, God said, I will be with you, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have come, when you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God. You'll worship God together on this mountain. And so Moses is going to deliver. Moses is going to rescue. Moses is going to restore the worship of God to people on earth. And so the question has to be asked, if we're reading this for the first time, is Moses the blessing? Is Moses the one? Is he the chosen one, the one that's going to deal finally with sin and deal with all these issues and be that rescuer? And so the story continues through the ministry of Moses, and we see that God delivers his covenant people from Egypt in what we call the Exodus through with the 10 plagues, and that's in Exodus chapter 7 through 12. And that's it's not our purpose this morning to study through those chapters. But then they escape from Egypt impossibly through the Red Sea, thanks to God, again through Moses. And God reveals to Moses this profound truth. We're going to be in chapter 19 now. He reveals to Moses in Exodus chapter 19 this truth about what is actually coming. What is coming? And so we've got to be asking this question. As they've crossed the Red Sea, things seem to be gaining momentum. Things seem to be looking pretty good. Is this Moses? We didn't know up until this point the plan. We don't know how the rescuer, how the blessing, how the offspring is going to finally restore the worship of God, restore the relationship with God, end sin and all of its issues. We don't know. And so God begins to reveal to Moses what exactly is coming in Exodus chapter 19, verse 3. Moses goes up to God at Mount Sinai, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, this is what you are to say to the descendants of Jacob and what you are to tell the people of Israel. And there he just uses Jacob's two names. Jacob was called Jacob, but he was also called Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. Moses, these are the words you're to speak to the Israelites. And so Moses went back and summoned the elders of the people and set before them all the words the Lord had commanded him to speak. And then the people, when they heard from the elders, all responded together, we will do everything the Lord said. And so Moses brought their answer back to the Lord. But he explains to Moses, here's what I'm thinking. Here's what I'm looking for. Here's what I'm hoping. Out of all the nations, you're going to be my treasured possession. My people, my kingdom of priests, a holy nation, holy, set apart from sin, set apart from all the wickedness of the world around you. And so you read these words, holy, my people, my kingdom. And all of this is communicated with the people through Moses. And Moses delivered them. Moses is their go-between from God to them. Moses gives them the conditions of the covenant, and that's in chapters 20 to 23. He gives them the conditions of this, if you're going to be my people, and I'm going to be with you, and I'm going to be your God, and I'm going to be the one who goes with you, then here's my conditions, here's what I'm going to be expecting of you. How their relationship is going to work. So this relationship, the land that they're going to, the nation that they're supposed to be, is Moses the blessing? Is he the one that's finally going to end this? Is this how Satan and sin, is this the way that Satan and sin are going to be dealt with and crushed through the ministry of Moses and this covenant? And then if we follow his story and where our hope builds, if you turn to Exodus chapter 32, As our wondering, is this it? Is this really, is Moses the one? I mean, look what he's doing. He's rescuing the people of God. He's returning them to the land. The land was part of the covenant. He's preserving the nation. The nation was part of the covenant. The only thing that we haven't found yet is the blessing. Is Moses the blessing? Is he the one, the offspring? And we get moments like this in Exodus 32. If you look at verse 9, where God is very frustrated with the people. But in verse 9, he's talking to Moses and he says, I've seen these people, this is right after they make a golden calf and say, we're going to worship this as a representation of God of sorts. And so God says, I've seen these people. They're a stiff-necked people. It means stubborn. Now leave me alone so that my anger may burn against them and that I may destroy them. Then I will make you into a great nation. So Moses is standing in the way of God's wrath against these people. And God actually tells him, Moses, I need you to leave so I can do what I want to do. I need you to leave so I can be angry and in my anger punish these people. You're standing in the way, Moses. What I'd like to do is start over with you. I want to start over with Moses and make a great nation out of you. This sounds a lot like Noah. I want to make you into a great nation, Moses, because these, I'm done with them, but you're in the way. Can you get out of my way so I can do this? And Moses, though, in verse 11, he sought the favor of the Lord his God. Lord, he said, why should your anger burn against your people, whom you brought out of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say, it was with evil intent that God brought them out to kill them in the mountains and wipe them off the face of the earth? Turn from your fierce anger, relent, and do not bring disaster to your people. Remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, to whom you swore by yourself, I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky. I will give your descendants all this land. I promised them, and it will be their inheritance forever. And the Lord relented, did not bring on his people the disaster he had threatened. And you notice there that Moses reminds him of the covenant. He reminds him of the promise. He goes toe to toe with God. And the only thing he doesn't mention in Abraham's promise is the blessing. But we're meant to wonder, is that because he is the blessing? He is the one. He's the one standing with God. He's the one saving this people. And he's the one that God actually admits, I'd start over with you, Moses. I want to start over with you. Moses reminds God, though, about his promise of land and nation, but we wonder, is Moses the blessing? He's been there saving and guiding God's people all along, and Moses is the only one, we discover two chapters later in Exodus chapter 34, Moses is the only one that's able to enter God's presence. In Exodus chapter 34, now verse 29, we read that when Moses comes down from Mount Sinai, he's got the tablets of the covenant law in his hands, those are the Ten Commandments, but probably more. He was not aware, because he had been with God, that his face was radiant, because he spoke with the Lord. And when Aaron, his brother, and all the Israelites saw Moses, his face was radiant, and they were afraid to come near him. As I imagine, you would probably, today we have a word for that, radioactive, and you would probably see somebody with a flashlight for a face and go, I'm not sure I should get close to you. This seems to be a little bit suspicious. And so they don't want to get near him, but Moses, verse 31, calls to them. So Aaron and all the leaders of the community came back to him, and he spoke to them. But afterward, verse 32, all the other Israelites came near him, and he gave them all the commands the Lord had given him on Mount Sinai. And when Moses finished speaking to them, he put a veil over his face to cover the shine. But whenever he entered the Lord's presence to speak with him, he removed the veil until he came out. And when he came out and told the Israelites what he had been commanded, and they saw his face was radiant again. But we find there that Moses is the only one able to enter God's presence. Everybody else is afraid to. They don't even want to go near Moses because Moses had been in God's presence. So Moses has a relationship with God unlike the people around him, anyone else around him. And that's undeniable when you read the Old Testament, when you read Exodus. He is God's mouthpiece. He is God's, he's the mediator, the go-between. He represents the people to God, and he represents God to the people in the covenant, in the promise, in pursuing it, in fulfilling it. He's leading the people. He's the agent time and time again of representation for these people in their relationship with God. He has, looking at it this way, restored the people's relationship with God. And a case in point now in Numbers chapter 21, and this one will be on the screen. In Numbers chapter 21, we see Moses taking a very suspicious but incredible position. So they're traveling from Mount Hor along the route to the Red Sea, and they're going to go around Edom. But the people, as they do, grew impatient on the way. They Everybody wants a shortcut. Nobody likes to take the long way, the scenic route. Listen, nobody wants to stop at the New River Gorge when you're going down to South Carolina. Personal thing, my parents do that every single time. They want to stop at the New River Gorge on the way home, and I just want to go home. Nobody wants to take the long way around. It's beautiful, I understand. A lot of you have great pictures of the New River Gorge. I just like to get there. But so everybody wants to take a shortcut, and so they begin to complain and get impatient on the way. And so they spoke against God and against Moses. They get upset. So the Lord sent venomous snakes among them, and they bit the people, and many Israelites died because of their lack of trust in God. And the people came to Moses and said, so we're thinking, it's become pretty obvious to us in the recent days that we sinned when we spoke against the Lord and against you. Will you, Moses, pray that the Lord will take the snakes away from us? Moses, will you save us from God's punishment? So Moses prayed for the people, and the Lord said to Moses, make a snake and put it on a pole, and anyone who is bitten can look at it and live. And so Moses made a bronze snake, put it up on a pole, and then when anyone was bitten by a snake and looked at the bronze snake, they lived. And this is a test of faith, a test of confidence, for people to express their faith in God, to say, this sounds weird, but if you said it, I'm going to do it, if this is going to heal me. But what they don't know, and they think Moses is our Savior in here in this moment, is that they're actually getting a picture of the true Savior, the one that will come and be lifted on a pole to save them. But again, we know that, they don't. And so when we look at this situation and the story in Numbers, we have to be asking again, is Moses the one? Is this him? Is he the blessing? Is he the chosen one? Maybe. But then we read this in Deuteronomy chapter 32. Again, it's going to be on the screen. Deuteronomy chapter 32, verses 50 to 52. God is talking to Moses, having a really personal conversation with him. This is kind of toward the end of Moses' story. And he says, here on the mountain that you've climbed, the one where you can see the promised land, you'll die. And you'll be gathered to your people, just as your brother Aaron died back on Mount Hor and was gathered to his people, meaning they're going to have a funeral for you, Moses. This is because both of you broke faith with me in the presence of the Israelites at the waters of Meribah Kadesh in the desert of Zin, and because you did not uphold my holiness among the Israelites. See, Moses sinned. He acted out of a lack of faith. When God told him to do one thing, he instead chose to do another thing, very similar to two original people in the garden. Turns out, sin is in Moses. Moses sinned, and so Moses is going to die. So God says, therefore you will see the land only from a distance. You will not enter the land I'm giving to the people of Israel. Moses won't see the promise fulfilled. Despite all that he is and all that he does for God's covenant people, he is the deliverer, he is a mediator, but he's a sinner. Moses has his own sins, his own disobedience, and his own unbelief, and as a consequence, he's denied entrance into the promised land of the covenant. Moses isn't the blessing. It felt so close. It seemed like maybe. And we read at the end of Deuteronomy, in chapter 34, verses 5 and 6, and then also in verses 10 to 12, that Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in Moab, as the Lord had said. God buried him in Moab, in the valley opposite Beth Peor. But to this day, no one knows where his grave is. That's because God buried him. And since then, no prophet has risen in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, who did all those signs and wonders the Lord sent him to do in Egypt, to Pharaoh and to all his officials and to his whole land. For no one has ever shown the mighty power or performed the awesome deeds that Moses did in the sight of Israel. This is Joshua writing the postscript to Moses' story, not realizing that there will one day be someone who has seen God face to face, who is in fact God, and who will do again the mighty wonders that Moses did. But in this moment, at the end of Deuteronomy, what we're discovering is that Moses isn't the blessing. Moses was the greatest man of Jewish history, and God himself buried him, but that's because Moses died. Moses couldn't end the curse of sin and the death that sin brought with it. The greatest man in Jewish history died. And even though he had laws direct from God, Moses couldn't crush Satan and his offspring's sin. Moses lessened the effect of sin's corruption with those laws, but even Moses couldn't end his own sin, let alone the sin of others. No matter how many laws, no matter how many guidelines they followed and sacrifices they made, Moses died. Death wasn't defeated by those laws. Sin wasn't given an obstacle they couldn't overcome with those guidelines. Moses wasn't the blessing. And reflecting on this fact, the author of Hebrews says in Hebrews chapter 3, verse 5, that Moses wasn't the blessing. Moses was a faithful servant in all God's house. He bore witness to what would be spoken by God in the future. Moses was a servant, but he wasn't the son. He wasn't the blessing. Moses was great, but he was just a servant. And this is the highest Greek word for a servant, only used of Moses in the New Testament. Moses is given incredible respect, but he was still just a servant in the house. He wasn't the blessing. He was a servant to God's community. He managed, he represented, he had an important function. In fact, his works, what he accomplished as deliverer and lawgiver and intercessor and more, they were meant to be an example, a predecessor even. It was meant to give people a taste and point to what the blessing, the true offspring, the sin crusher would accomplish. He was supposed to give us a taste and make us think, man, if it wasn't Moses, what's he going to be like? The true blessing would fully deliver and would fully intercede, but in a way that completely crushes Satan and sin. Moses couldn't do that. He couldn't fully deliver from sin. He couldn't fully intercede for men and restore that relationship because he was in the house. He was part of the house. He was part of the community. He wasn't the owner. He was just one of the rest, just a significant one. So if Moses wasn't him, what are some of our takeaways this morning that we can have to anticipate the one? First, I think we can learn and take away that without God's direct intervention and presence, men are lost. Without God's intervention, without God's presence, men are lost. If you look back again at Exodus chapter 33, Moses actually says this in verse 14. God again has been frustrated, and he said, Moses, I'll guide you, but I can't keep coming down. I can't keep being here. My presence can't be here with this people. I'll guide you to the promised land, but this is too much for me. And so Moses encourages God. And so the Lord replied in verse 14 of Exodus chapter 33, okay, my presence will go with you, and I'll give you rest. And then Moses reiterates in verse 15, he says to him, if your presence does not go with us, don't send us up from here. How will anyone know that you are pleased with me and with your people unless you go with us? What else will distinguish me and your people from all the other people on the face of the earth? Without God's presence and his interaction, men are lost. Moses panics for a moment when God suggests that maybe the Israelites will have to go on without him. And he profoundly says, to paraphrase, we're lost without your presence. Don't do this. We are lost without you. We need you. We need you to guide us out of this mess. And he's right. Without God's intervention, without God's presence, we are lost. Without God's intervention and presence in your life, you are lost. Peter, author in the New Testament, identifies the issue as well. Because of sin, he says, quoting from the Old Testament, that we're lost sheep, and we need a shepherd. We need an overseer of our souls. He says it in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 25. Without God, you are like sheep going astray. You are lost. Isaiah continues, going your own way, right? Whatever makes sense, you do it. You go and you just wander around the wilderness. But now, if you believe in the one, in the offspring, in the blessing, the true deliverer, you return then to the shepherd and the overseer of your souls. You need that shepherd and that overseer of your soul. So this blessing must bring with him, then we learn, if Moses couldn't bring the presence of God that every man needed to stay found, to not be lost anymore, then what we learn is that this blessing must bring with him the very presence of God. Otherwise, we're lost. We need God or we are lost. Lost in sin, and lost to die without hope. And the more direct his presence is, the better we are. In fact, we would be best off if God were to come to us in person, is what we learn from Moses. We would be best off if God came to us in the flesh. We need him, because without him, we're lost and hopeless. The second thing that we can take away from Moses' story and revealing that he isn't the blessing is not just that without God's direct presence and intervention that we're lost, but also if we have any hope relating to God, if we have any hope of a relationship with God, we need help. We need a mediator. We need someone to stand between us for when God looks at us and rightfully says, oh, I just want to punch them. We need someone to stand in there. We need help. And the problem is, unless that person is the offspring that crushes sin, they have their own sin to worry about, where every once in a while, God instead will look at them and say, crush them. I want to come after you. Look at what you've been doing. You're going to die here on this hill, Moses, because you were unfaithful. So unless that person is the offspring that ends sin, they're going to have their own sin to need help with and deal with. Isaiah was painfully aware, when you read the beginning of his book, he was painfully aware that as a man, he shouldn't be in the presence of God. I shouldn't be here, he says in the beginning of Isaiah. When he sees God's glory, when he sees the holiness of God and the angels around him, Isaiah goes, I am in the wrong place. I should not be in the presence of God because I'm a man. I am sinful. The author of Hebrews says that the issue with the Jewish priests, who were men, they helped represent God to men and represent men to God, but the issue was that they had their own sins that needed dealt with, their own issues of disobeying God, so they couldn't ever actually completely stand between God and men because they had sinned. They wore bells to go in between God and men because they might die in there because of their own sin. No man can stand between God and men because of their own sin. That's what happened to Moses. But to come to God, to relate to God, to return to the relationship that was lost, we need help. We need a mediator who can stand between us and God and repair that relationship without any concern for their own sin. But that would mean that the blessing would have to be sinless. That would mean that the offspring would have to have no sin at all to worry about, so that he can 100% be our advocate and help us have that full relationship with God. We can't do that on our own. No man can do that representation on our behalf. And so what we learn from Moses is that if we have any hope of relationship with God, we need help, and not just from any man. And the third lesson, third takeaway, and again, the hope is that this builds anticipation, where we look at these statements and we say, yes, yes, we need the offspring. We need the one. We need the Messiah. And I know who he is. But the third is that even the most devoted servant wasn't able to find or offer rest from sin. Last week, it was that even the most righteous man on earth wasn't able to be saved without faith. And this week, we see that even the most devoted servant doing the most for God wasn't able to find rest from his sin, still had to suffer the consequence, the punishment of his sin. But what we truly need is rest from sin. That's what we're yearning and what we're groaning for. In Romans, not just us, the whole world, Romans chapter 8, Paul says in verses 20 to 21 that creation, because of Adam and Eve and the rest of us, was subjected to frustration. It wasn't its own choice. It was by the will of the one who subjected it, in the hope that, though, the creation will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and the glory of the children of God. Creation wants rest from sin. Men want rest from sin. We don't want to keep dealing with this. We need rest from sin, but rest is elusive. Sin is exhausting. It is exhausting to live in a world of sin. It is exhausting to deal with day in and day out our own insufficiencies, our own shortcomings, our own struggles, and know at the end of the day, no matter how hard I try, no matter how devoted I was, God is going to look at me and find something wrong. It is exhausting. It's a struggle. And if Moses, the most devoted of all Jews, the one who carried the Ten Commandments, if he wasn't able to find rest from sin through all of his efforts, neither can we through whatever efforts that we offer up. Sin cannot simply be avoided or drowned out or outperformed. Rest from our sin and its consequences is elusive as long as sin dwells inside each of us. We're slaves to it. We are slaves that need a rescuer, just like the Israelites. We're lost. We need help. And we will never find rest in this condition on our own. What we need is a Savior, a sin crusher, someone who can defeat sin and end death once and for all. You know how this ends. So we look forward to this year, December 24th, to celebrate the One. And if you know Him and believe in Him, I hope the anticipation is growing. If you don't know the sin crusher, if you can't say that you are freed from sin, that you would say, I still struggle with it day in and day out, that I am not good enough for God, and I don't have any confidence in anyone, anywhere to save me from this. Pastor Jerry or myself would love to share with you how Jesus solved it all for you. Would you find us after the service? But let's pray. God, we are not good enough. We are not able in any way to solve our problem with sin. We need you. We need your rescue. And I know that you have had the plan and you have carried out the plan. And so we trust you with our insufficiencies. We trust you with our inability. We trust you with our lack of full devotion that deals with sin, because we are sinful and we admit that. I admit that for myself. I admit that on behalf of my brothers and sisters. We are not good enough for you. We are sinful and we are sorry. We need your forgiveness and we need your help. Thank you for knowing that. And while we were still sinners, sending your Son to help, to mediate, to deliver and save us. I love you, God. I'm not ashamed to say that I love you, because you love me first. I pray this in your name. Amen.